Maybe he took up hacking in the 5 years he was gone, she said sarcastically. Have you talked to Michael? Does he know Brian's out? That's the first place I called. Michael went to work early, but I talked to Juliet and really put the fear of God in her. She's crazy about Brian, and she doesn't have a grain of sense. I made her swear she would call me if either of them heard from him. What about Wendell? Would he know how to reach Michael at the new address? Why not? All he has to do is call information. The new number's listed. It isn't any big secret. Why, do you think Brian and Wendell would try to connect at Michael's? I don't know. Do you? She thought about it for a moment. It's possible, she said. She pressed her hands between her knees to still their shaking. I probably ought to go, I said. I'm staying close to the phone. If you learn anything, will you let me know? Of course. I left Dana's and headed over to the Perdido Keys. My prime worry at the moment was the whereabouts of Renata's boat. If Wendell had really found a way to arrange Brian's release, his next move would be getting the kid out of the country. I pulled into a McDonald's and used the payphone in the parking lot, dialing Renata's unlisted number without luck. I could hardly remember when I'd eaten last, so while I was on the premises, I availed myself of the facilities, then picked up lunch. A QP with cheese, a Coke, and a large order of fries, which I took out to the car. At least the smell of fast food obliterated the last traces of Jerry Irwin's sweat. When I reached Renata's, her big double garage door was wide open, and there was no Jaguar in evidence. I did catch a glimpse of the boat at the dock, two wooden masts visible above the fence. The house itself showed no interior lights, and there was no indication of activity. I parked my VW about 3 doors away and demolished my meal, remembering as I finished that I'd already eaten lunch. I checked my watch. Ah, but that was hours ago. Well, two of them at any rate. I sat in my car and waited. Since my car radio wasn't working and I hadn't brought anything to read, I found myself ruminating about the sudden acquisition of family relationships. What was I going to do about them? Grandmother, aunts, cousins of every description? Not that they'd lost any sleep over me. There was something troubling about the feelings being stirred up. Most of them were bad. I'd never devoted any thought to the fact that my father was a mail carrier. I had known, of course, but the information had no impact, and I usually had no reason to reflect on the significance. All that news being delivered, the good and the bad, debts and remittances, accounts payable, accounts receivable, dividend checks, canceled notes, word about babies being born and old friends dying, the Dear John letters breaking off engagements. That was the task he'd been charged with in this world, an occupation my grandmother apparently judged too lowly for consideration. Maybe Burton and Grand truly felt it was their responsibility to see that my mother chose well in this matter of a husband. I felt defensive of him, brooding and protective. With Liza's revelation, I'd caught a glimpse of whole dramas that had been acted out without my knowledge. Quarrels and rituals, the gentle cooing of women, raucous laughter, cozy chats in the kitchen over cups of coffee, holiday dinners, babies born, advice offered up, the hand-embroidered linens passed down from one generation to the next. It was a ladies' magazine picture of the family. Abundant, cinnamon-scented, filled with pine boughs and ornaments, football games on the color TV set in the den, uncles dazed by too much to eat, children glassy-eyed and hyper from all the naps they'd skipped. My world seemed bleak by comparison, and for once the Spartan, stripped-down lifestyle I so cherished seemed paltry and deprived. I stirred on my seat, nearly paralyzed with boredom. There was no reason to believe Renata Huff would show up. Surveillance is a bitch. It's tough to sit and stare at the front of a house for 5 or 6 hours at a stretch. It's hard to pay attention. It's hard to give a shit. Usually I have to think of it as a Zen meditation, imagining I'm in touch with my higher power instead of just my bladder. Daylight began to fade. I watched the color of the sky shift from apricot to blush. The temperature was dropping almost palpably. Summer evenings are usually chilly, and with this storm system lurking off the coast, the days seemed as short as some premature autumn. I could see a fog bank moving in, a wall of dark clouds against the rapidly accumulating cobalt blue of the twilight sky. I crossed my arms in front of me for warmth, slouching down on my seat. Another hour must have passed. I felt my awareness flicker and my head jerked involuntarily as I lurched out of sleep. I sat up straight and made a conscious effort to keep myself awake. This lasted about a minute. Various body parts began to hurt, and I thought about how babies cry when they're tired. Staying awake becomes a physical agony when the body needs rest. I shifted, turning sideways. I pulled my knees up and swung my feet onto the passenger seat, resting my back against the car door where the armrest protruded. I felt like I was drunk, my eyes rolling in their sockets as I fought to keep them open. I imagined the chemicals from all that junk food coursing through my body with this narcotic effect. This was never going to do. I had to have fresh air. I had to get up and move. I checked my glove compartment for my penlight and a set of key picks. I tucked my handbag on the floor out of sight and grabbed a jacket from the back seat. I got out, locked the car door, and crossed the street at an angle, moving toward Renata's with a devilish urge to snoop. Really, it wasn't my fault. I can't be held responsible when boredom sets in. For the sake of good manners, I rang the doorbell first, knowing in my heart that not a soul would come to answer. Sure enough, no response. What's a poor girl to do? I let myself through the side gate and moved around to the rear. I moved down to the dock, which seemed to rock beneath me. Renata's boat, ironically, had been named the Fugitive, a 48-foot catch, sleek white, with an aft center cockpit and an aft cabin. The body was fiberglass, the deck oiled teak, the trim of varnished walnut, fittings of chrome and brass. The boat would probably sleep six in comfort, eight in a pinch. There were numerous vessels moored on either side of the quay, lights shimmering against the black depths of the barely rippling water. What could be better for Wendell's purposes than to have ready access to the ocean through the quays? He might have been sailing in and out of here for years, wholly anonymous, wholly undetected. I made a feeble effort to halloo the boat, which produced no results. This was not surprising, as the boat was dark and shrouded in canvas. I went on board, clambering over cables. I unzipped the cover in three places, pushing sections back. The cabin was locked, but I used my penlight to peer through the hatches, sweeping my beam through the galley below. The interior was immaculate. Beautiful inlaid woods, muted upholstery in soft sunset hues. Supplies had been laid in, canned goods and bottled water in neatly stacked cardboard boxes, waiting to be stowed. I lifted my head and scanned the houses on either side. I couldn't see a soul. I checked the houses across the way. There were numerous lights on, occasional glimpses of the residence, but no indication that I was being watched. I crawled along the deck toward the bow until I reached the hatch above the V-berth. The bed was neatly made, and there were personal effects visible, clothing, paperback books, framed photographs that I couldn't quite make out. I moved back to the galley and sat on the aft deck, working at the tubular lock that was set into the wood between my knees. A lock of this type usually has seven pins, and is best attacked with a commercially available pick tool, which was part of the set I had with me. This small handheld device is the approximate size of an old-fashioned porcelain faucet handle of the sort where hot and cold are printed across the surface in blue. The tool contains seven thin metal fingers that adjust themselves to correspond to the cut depth of a key. An in-and-out motion is applied, while a slight turning force is applied at the same time, a rubber sleeve providing friction that holds the fingers firmly in place. Once the lock opens, the tool can be used as an actual key. The lock finally yielded, but not without a few well-chosen curses. I tucked the tool in my jeans and slid back the hatch, easing myself down the galley steps. Sometimes I'm sorry I didn't hang in with the Girl Scouts. I might have qualified for some keen merit badges, breaking and entering being one. I moved through the cabin, using my penlight, searching every drawer and cubbyhole I could find. I'm not even sure what I was looking for. A complete travel itinerary would have been a boon. Passports, visas, charts marked with conspicuous red arrows and asterisks. Confirmation of Wendell's presence would have been lovely, too. There was nothing of interest. About the time I ran out of steam, I also ran out of luck. I flipped off the penlight and I was just coming up the galley steps, emerging from the cabin, when Renata appeared. I found myself staring down the barrel of a .357 Magnum revolver. The damn gun was huge and looked like something an old Western marshal might carry in a holster hanging halfway to his knees. I stopped in my tracks, instantly aware of the hole a gun like that can make in parts of the anatomy essential to life. I felt my hands come up, the universal gesture of goodwill and cooperation. Renata was apparently unaware of this, as her attitude was hostile and her tone of voice belligerent. "Who are you?" "I'm a private investigator. My ID's in my handbag, which is out in the car." "You know I could kill you for trespassing on this boat." "I'm aware of that. I'm kind of hoping you won't." She stared at me, perhaps trying to decipher my tone, which was probably not as respectful as she might have wished.
"What were you doing back there?"
I turned my head slightly, as if looking at the "back there" might help me recall. I decided it was the wrong time to bullshit. "I was looking for Wendell Jaffe. His son was released from the Perdido County Jail this morning, and I thought the two might be planning to connect. I thought we'd have to stop and play out some kind of nonsense along the lines of, 'Who is Wendell Jaffe?' but she seemed willing to play the scene the way I'd said it. I didn't articulate the rest of my suspicion, which was that Wendell, Brian, and Renata probably intended to defect on this very boat. By the way, just to satisfy my curiosity, was Wendell the one who set up that jail release?"
"Possibly."
"How'd he manage that?"
"Haven't I seen you somewhere before?"
"Viento Negro, last week. I tracked you to the Hacienda Grande." Even in the shadows, I saw her eyebrows lift, and I decided to leave her with the impression that it was my superior detecting that unearthed them. Why mention Dick Mills when his spotting Wendell was dumb luck on his part? I wanted her to think of me as Wonder Woman, bullets ricocheting off my wristbands. "I tell you what," I said conversationally. "You don't really need to keep that gun on me. I'm unarmed myself, and I'm not going to do anything rash." Slowly, I lowered my hands. I expected her to protest, but she didn't seem to notice. She seemed undecided about what to do next. She could, of course, shoot me, but dead bodies are tricky to dispose of, and if not dispatched properly, tend to generate a lot of questions. The last thing she wanted was the sheriff's deputy at her door.
"What do you want with Wendell?"
"I work for the company that insured his life. His wife just collected $500,000, and if Wendell's not dead, they want their money back." I could see her hand tremble slightly, not from fear, but from the weight of the gun. I thought it was time to take action. I let out a piercing shriek and whacked her mightily across the wrist, using my arms as a sledgehammer, like the guys do in the movies. I suspect it was the shriek that made her loosen her grip. The gun flipped up like a pancake and then hit the deck, clattering across the floor of the cockpit. I pushed Renata backward, knocking her off balance, while I snatched it up. She went down on her backside. Now I held the gun. She scrambled to her feet and her hands came up. I liked this better, though I was just as baffled as she had been about what to do. I'm capable of violence when I'm under attack, but I wasn't going to shoot her while she stood there staring me in the face. I just had to hope she didn't know that. I assumed an aggressive stance, feet spread, gun held with both hands, my arms stiff. "Where's Wendell? I need to talk to him." She made a little squeaking sound in her throat. A fiery patch formed around her nose, and then her whole face screwed up as she started to weep. "Cut the crap, Renata, and give me the information, or I will shoot your right foot on the count of five." I aimed at her right foot. 1, 2, 3, 4.
"He's at Michael's."
"Thank you. I appreciate that. You're too kind," I replied. "I'll leave the gun in your mailbox." She shuddered involuntarily.
"Keep it. I hate guns."
I tucked the gun in my waistband at the small of my back and hopped nimbly to the dock. When I looked back at her, she was clinging weakly to the mast. I left my business card in her mailbox and tucked another one in her door. Then I drove to Michael's. Chapter 19. I could see lights on in the rear. I bypassed the doorbell and walked around to the backyard, peeking in every window I passed. The kitchen revealed nothing except counter surfaces piled with dirty dishes. Cardboard moving boxes still formed the bulk of the furnishings, the crumpled paper now massed like a cloud bank in the corner. When I reached the master bedroom, I saw that Juliet, in a grip of home decorating tips, had draped hand towels over tension rods, effectively obscuring my view. I returned to the front door, wondering if I'd be forced to knock like a mere commoner. I tried the knob and discovered to my delight that I could walk right in. The television set in the living room had gone on the blink. In lieu of a color picture, there was a display of dancing lights equal to an aurora borealis. The sound that accompanied this remarkable phenomenon suggested tough guys with guns and a thrilling car chase. I peered toward the bedrooms, but I couldn't hear much above the squealing of car brakes and the firing of Uzis. I took out Renata's gun, pointing it like a flashlight as I eased my way cautiously to the back of the house. The baby's bedroom was dark, but the door to the master bedroom was open a crack, and light slanted into the hall. I gave the door a little push with the barrel of my gun. It swung back with a creak, the hinge singing on its pin. Before me, on a rocking chair, Wendell Jaffe was sitting with his grandson in his lap. He made a sharp, startled sound.
"Don't shoot the baby!"
"I'm not going to shoot the baby. What's the matter with you?" Brendan was grinning at the sight of me, flailing his arms in a vigorous nonverbal greeting. He wore a flannel sleeper with blue bunnies, and his back end was bulky with a disposable diaper. His blonde hair was still damp from a recent bath. Juliet had brushed it up in a delicate question mark on top. I could smell the baby powder halfway across the room. I put the gun away, tucking it in my blue jeans at the small of my back. This is not a cool place to carry, and I was perfectly aware that I risked shooting myself in the butt. On the other hand, I didn't want the gun shoved down in my handbag, where it would be even less accessible than it was wedged up against my rear. As family reunions go, this didn't seem to be that good. So far, Brendan was the only one who was having any fun. Michael stood to one side, leaning against the chest of drawers, his expression withdrawn. He studied Wendell's class ring, which he seemed to use like a meditation, turning it on his finger. I've seen professional tennis players do that, focusing on the strings of a tennis racket to maintain concentration. Michael's sweatshirt, soiled jeans, and mud-caked boots suggested that he hadn't cleaned up after work. I could still see the ridge in his hair where he'd worn his hard hat that day. Wendell must have been waiting when he walked in the door. Juliet was huddled at the head of the bed, looking tense and small in a tank top and cutoffs. Her feet were bare, legs drawn up, her arms wrapped around her knees. She was keeping herself out of the way, letting the drama play out as it would. The only illumination in the room was a table lamp, something imported from Juliet's childhood bedroom at home. The shade was ruffled and hot pink. At the base there was a doll with a stiff pink skirt, her body wired to the fixture, her arms extended. She had a rosebud for a mouth, and her lashes formed a thick fringe above eyes that would open and shut mechanically. The light bulb couldn't have been more than 40 watts, but the room seemed warm with its ambient glow. Juliet's features were etched in sharp contrasts, one cheek hot pink, the other cast in shadow. Wendell's face looked craggy and wooden in the light, his high cheekbones carved. He seemed haggard, and the sides of his nose were shiny from cosmetic surgery. Michael, on the other hand, had the face of a stone angel, cold and sensual. His dark eyes seemed luminous, his tall, lanky frame easily the equal to his father's, though Wendell was heavier and he lacked Michael's grace. The three of them were caught in a curious tableau, the kind of picture a psychiatrist might ask you to explain to gain insight into your mindset. "Hello, Wendell. Sorry to interrupt. Remember me?" Wendell's gaze shifted to Michael's face. He cocked his head in my direction.
"Who's this?"
Michael stared at the floor.
"Private investigator," he said. "She talked to Mom about you a couple of nights ago."
I gave Wendell a little wave. "She works for the insurance company you cheated out of $500,000, I inserted.
"I did?"
"Yes, Wendell," I said facetiously. "As odd as it sounds, that's what life insurance is about, being dead. So far, you're not holding up your end of the bargain." He was looking at me with a mixture of caution and confusion.
"Don't I know you?"
"We crossed paths at the hotel down in Viento Negro." His eyes locked on mine in a moment of recognition.
"Were you the one who broke into our room?"
I shook my head, inventing lies on the spot. "Not me. That was an ex-cop named Harris Brown. He shook his head at the name. He's a police lieutenant, or he was, I went on.
Never heard of him.
Well, he's heard of you. He was assigned to the case when you first disappeared. Then he was taken off for reasons unknown. I thought you might explain.
Are you sure he was looking for me?
I don't think his being there was a coincidence, I said. He stayed in 314. I was in 316.
Hey, Dad, could we finish this?
Brendan began to fuss, and Wendell patted at him without much effect. He picked up a small stuffed puppy dog and waggled it in Brendan's face while he continued his conversation. Brendan grabbed the animal by the ears and pulled it in close. He must have been teething, because he gnawed on its rubber face with all the raw enthusiasm I reserve for fried chicken. Somehow his antics became an odd counterpoint to Wendell's conversation with Michael. He apparently picked up from a point he'd been making prior to my arrival.
I had to get out, Michael. It had nothing to do with you. It was my life. It was me. I'd just screwed up so bad there wasn't any other way to handle it. I hope you'll understand someday. There's no such thing as justice in the current legal system. Oh, come on, spare me the speech. What is this, a political science class? Just cut the shit and don't talk to me about fucking justice, okay? You didn't hang around long enough to find out. Please, Michael, let's stop this. I don't want to fight. There isn't time for that. I don't expect you to agree with my decision. It isn't just me, Dad. What about Brian? He's the one suffered all the damage. I'm aware he's off course and I'm doing what I can, Wendell said. Brian needed you when he was 12. It's too late now.
I don't think so. Not at all. You're wrong about that. Trust me.
Michael seemed to wince, and his eyes rolled toward the ceiling.
Trust you? Dad, you are so full of shit. Why should I trust you? I'm never going to trust you.
Wendell seemed disconcerted at the harshness of Michael's tone. He didn't like being contradicted. He wasn't accustomed to having his judgment questioned, especially by a kid who was 17 when he left. Michael had become an adult in his absence, had in fact stepped in to fill the very gap that Wendell had left. Maybe he pictured himself coming back to mend the breach, cleaning up old business, setting everything to rights. Maybe he'd thought an impassioned explanation might somehow compensate for his abandonment and neglect.
I guess there's no way we can agree, he said. Why didn't you come back and face what you did?
I couldn't come back.
I didn't see a way to make it work.
Meaning you weren't interested. Meaning you didn't want to be asked to make any sacrifices in our behalf. Thanks a bunch. We appreciate your devotion. It's typical.
Now, son, that's not true.
Yes, it is. You could have stayed if you wanted, if we meant anything to you. But here's the truth. We didn't matter to you, and that was just our tough luck, right?
Of course you matter. What do you think I've been talking about?
I don't know, Dad. As far as I can tell, you're just trying to justify your behavior.
This is pointless. I can't undo the past. I can't change what happened back then. Brian and I are going to turn ourselves in. That's the best I can do. And if that's not good enough, then I don't know what to say.
Michael broke off eye contact, shaking his head with frustration. I watched him consider and discard a retort. Wendell cleared his throat.
I have to go. I told Brian I'd be there.
He got to his feet, shifting the baby against his shoulder. Juliet swung her legs over to the side of the bed and got up, prepared to take Brendan from his grandfather's arms. It was clear the conversation had upset her. Her nose was pink, her mouth swollen with emotion. Michael shoved his hands down in his pockets.
You didn't do Brian any favor with that fake jail release.
That's true, as it turned out, but there was no way we could know that. I've changed my mind about a lot of things. Anyway, this is something your brother and I have to work out between us.
You've got Brian in worse trouble than he was in before. You don't move fast, the cops will pick him up and throw him back in the slammer, and he won't see daylight till he's 103. And where will you be? Off on a fucking boat without a care in the world? Good luck.
Doesn't it occur to you that I'll have to pay a price, too?
At least you don't have a murder charge hanging over your head.
I'm not sure there's any point in going on with this,
Wendell said, ignoring the actual content of Michael's remark. The two of them seemed to be talking at cross-purposes. Wendell was trying to reassert his parental authority. Michael wasn't having any of that shit. He had a son now himself, and he knew how much his father had forfeited. Wendell turned away.
"I have to go," he said, holding one hand out to Juliet.
"I'm glad we had a chance to meet. It's too bad the circumstances weren't happier."
"Are we going to see you again?" Juliet said. Tears were spilling down her cheeks. Mascara had formed a sprinkling of soot beneath her eyes. Michael seemed watchful, his expression haunted, while grief poured from Juliet like water bursting through a wall. Even Wendell seemed affected by her open display of feeling.
"Absolutely, of course. That's a promise."
His gaze lingered on Michael, perhaps hoping for some sign of emotion.
"I'm sorry for the pain I caused you. I mean that."
Michael's shoulders hunched slightly with the effort to stay disconnected.
"Yeah, right. Whatever," he said.
Wendell hugged the baby to him, his face buried in Brendan's neck, drinking in the sweet, milky smell of the child.
"Oh, you sweet boy," he said, his voice tremulous.
Brendan was staring, fascinated, at Wendell's hair, which he grabbed. Solemnly, he tried to put a fistful in his mouth. Wendell winced, gently extracting the baby's fingers. Juliet reached for Brendan. Michael watched, his eyes pooling with silver, before he looked away. Sorrow rose from his skin like steam, radiating outward. Wendell passed the baby to Juliet and kissed her on the forehead before he turned to Michael. The two grabbed each other in a tight embrace that seemed to go on forever.
"I love you, son."
They rocked back and forth in an ancient dance. Michael made a small sound at the back of his throat, his eyes squeezed shut. For that one unguarded moment, he and Wendell were connected. I had to look away. I couldn't imagine what it must feel like to find yourself in the presence of a parent you thought was dead. Michael pulled back. Wendell took out a handkerchief and swiped at his eyes.
"I'll be in touch,"
he whispered, and then let out a breath. Without looking at them, he turned and left the room. His guilt probably felt oppressive, like a weight on his chest. He moved through the house, heading for the front door with me right behind him. If he was aware of my presence, he didn't object. The outside air had picked up a sting of moisture, wind tossing through the trees. The street lights were almost entirely blocked by branches, shadows blowing across the street like a pile of leaves. I intended to bid the man a fare thee well, get in my car, and then play tag with him, following at a discreet distance until he led me to Brian. As soon as I got a fix on the kid's location, I was calling the cops. I said good night and moved off in the opposite direction. I'm not sure he even heard me. Preoccupied, Wendell took out a set of car keys and crossed the grass to a little red Maserati sports car that was parked at the curb. Renata apparently had a fleet of expensive autos. He unlocked the car and let himself in, quickly sliding in under the steering wheel. He slammed the car door. I unlocked my VW and jammed my key in the ignition in concert with his. I could feel Renata's gun pressing into the small of my back. I pulled it out of my waistband. I torqued myself around to the back seat where I snagged my handbag and deposited the gun into the depths. I heard Wendell's engine grind. I fired mine up and sat there with the lights out, waiting for his front and rear lights to come on. The grinding continued, but his engine didn't turn over. The sound was high-pitched and unproductive. Moments later, I saw him fling open his car door and emerge. Agitated, he checked under the hood. He did something to the wires, got back into the car, and started grinding again. The engine was losing hope, batteries surrendering any juice they had. I put the VW in gear and flipped my lights on, pulling forward slowly until I was next to him. I rolled my window down. He leaned over from the driver's seat and rolled his down. I said, "Hop in. I'll take you to Renata's. You can call a tow truck from her place." He debated for a moment with a quick glance at Michael's. He didn't have much choice. The last thing in the world he wanted was to go back in with a chore as mundane as a call to AAA. He got out, locked his car, and came around the front, getting into mine. I turned right on Perdido Street and took a left before I reached the fairgrounds, thinking to hit the frontage road that ran along the beach. I could have hopped on the freeway. Traffic wasn't heavy. The street leading to the Keys was just one ramp away and just as easily reached by this route. I turned left when I reached the beach. The wind had picked up considerably, and there were massive black clouds above the pitch black of the ocean.
"I had a nice chat with Carl Monday night," I said.
"Have you talked to him?"
"I was supposed to meet with him later, but he had to go out of town," Wendell said, distracted.
"Really? He thought he'd be too mad to talk to you."
"We have business to settle. He has something of mine."
"You mean the boat?"
"Well, that too, but this is something else."
The sky was charcoal gray, and I could see flashes out at sea, an electrical storm sitting maybe 50 miles out. The light flickered among the darkening cloud banks, creating the illusion of artillery too far away to hear. The air was filled with a restless energy. I glanced over at Wendell.
"Aren't you even curious how we picked up your trail? I'm surprised you haven't asked."
His attention was fixed on the horizon, which was illuminated intermittently as the storm progressed.
"It doesn't matter. It was bound to happen sometime."
"You mind telling me where you've been all these years?"
He stared out the side window, his face averted.
"Not far. You'd be surprised how few places I've been."
"You gave up a lot to get there."
Pain flickered across his face like lightning.
"Yes."
"Have you been with Renata the whole time?"
"Oh, yes,"
he said with just a hint of bitterness. A small silence fell, and then he stirred uneasily.
"Do you think I'm wrong to come back like this?"
"Depends on what you were hoping to accomplish."
"I'd like to help them."
"Help them do what? Brian's already on his path, and so is Michael. Dana coped as well as she could, and the money's been spent. You can't just step back into the life you left and make all the stories come out differently. They're working out the consequences of your decision. You'll have to do that, too."
"I guess I can't expect to mend all my fences in the course of a few days."
"I'm not sure you can do it at all," I said. "In the meantime, I'm not going to let you out of my sight. I lost you once. I don't intend to lose you again."
"I need some time. I have business to take care of."
You had business to take care of 5 years ago."
"This is different."
"Where's Brian?"
"He's safe."
I didn't ask you how he was. I said where. The car began to lose speed. I looked down with bafflement, pumping the accelerator as the car slowed.
"Jesus, what's this? You out of gas?"
"I just filled the tank." I steered toward the right curb as the car drifted to a halt. He peered over at the dashboard.
"Gas gauge says full."
"What did I just tell you? Of course it's full. I just filled it." We had reached a full stop. The silence was profound, and then the underlying thrum of wind and surf filtered into my consciousness. Even with the moon obscured by storm clouds, I could see the whitecaps out in the water. I hauled my handbag from the back seat and fumbled in the front pocket until I found my penlight. "Let me see what's going on," I said, as though I had a clue. I got out of the car. Wendell got out on his side and moved around to the rear in concert with me. I was glad of his company. Maybe he knew something about cars that I didn't. No big trick. In situations like this, I always like to take action. I opened the back flap and stared at the engine. Looked like it always did, about the size and shape of a sewing machine. I expected to see sprung parts, broken doohickeys, the flapping ends of a fan belt, some evidence of rogue auto parts adrift from their moorings.
"What do you think?"
He took the penlight and leaned closer, squinting.
"Boys know about these things. Guns, cars, lawnmowers, garbage disposals, electric switches, baseball statistics. I'm scared to take the lid off the toilet tank because that ball thing always looks like it's on the verge of exploding." I leaned over and peered with him.
"Looks a little bit like a sewing machine, doesn't it?" he remarked.
Behind us, a car backfired and a rock slammed into my rear fender. Wendell made sense of it a split second before I did. We both hit the pavement. Wendell grabbed me and the two of us scrambled around to the side of the car. A second shot was fired and the bullet pinged off the roof. We ducked, hunched together. Wendell's arm had gone around me protectively. He flipped the switch on the penlight, making the pitch dark complete. I had a terrible desire to lift up to window level and peek out across the street. I knew there wouldn't be much to see. Dark, a dirt bank, swiftly passing cars on the freeway. Our assailant must have followed us from Michael's house, first incapacitating Wendell's car, and then mine.
"This has got to be one of your pals.
I'm not this unpopular in my set, I said.
Another shot was fired. My rear window turned to cracked ice, though only one chunk fell out.
Wendell said, Jesus!
I said, Amen.
Neither of us meant it as profanity.
He looked at me. His previous lethargy had vanished. At least his attention had been sharpened by the situation.
Someone's been following me the last few days.
You have a theory? He shook his head.
I made some phone calls. I needed help.
Who knew you were going to Michael's?
Just Renata.
I thought about that one. I'd taken her gun, which I remembered now was in my handbag, in the car.
I have a gun in the car if you can reach it, I said. My handbag's on the back seat. Won't the inside light come on?
In my car? Not a chance. Wendell opened the door on the passenger side.
Sure enough, the interior light came on.
The next bullet was swift and nearly caught him in the neck. We ducked down again, silent for a moment, while we thought about Wendell's carotid artery. I said,
Carl must have known you'd be at Michael's if you told him you'd meet him afterward. That was before his plans changed. Anyway, he doesn't know where Michael lives.
He says his plans changed, but you don't know that for a fact. It wouldn't take a rocket scientist to call information. All he had to do was ask Dana. He's kept in touch with her.
Hell, he's in love with Dana. He's always been in love with her. I'm sure he was delighted to have me out of the picture.
What about Harris Brown? He'd have a gun.
I told you before, I never heard of him.
Wendell, quit bullshitting. I need some answers here.
I'm telling you the truth.
Stay down. I'm going to try the card. 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 I'm going to door again.
Wendell flattened himself as I gave the door a yank. The next shot thunked into the sand close by.
I slipped the seat forward and grabbed my bag, hauled it out of the back seat, and slammed the door again.
My heart had rocketed. Anxiety was coursing through my body as if a sluice gate had opened.
I needed to pee like crazy, except for the fact that my kidneys had shriveled.
All my other internal organs had circled like wagons under serious attack.
I pulled out the revolver with its white perlite grips.
Give me some light over here.
Wendell flipped on the penlight, shielding it like a match. I was looking at the sort of single-action six-shooter John Wayne might have favored. I popped open the cylinder and checked the load, which was full. I snapped the cylinder shut. The gun must have weighed 3 pounds.
Where'd you get that?
I stole it from Renata. Wait here, I'll be back.
He said something to me, but I was already duck-walking my way out into the darkness, angling toward the beach and away from our assailant.
I cut left, circling out 100 yards around the front of the car, hoping I wasn't visible to anybody interested in target practice. My eyes were fully adjusted to the dark by now, and I felt conspicuous. I looked back, trying to measure the distance I'd come. My pale blue VW looked like some kind of ghostly igloo or a giant pup tent. I reached a left-turning curve in the road, crouched, and crossed in a flash, easing back toward the point from which I imagined our attacker was firing. It probably took 10 minutes until I reached the spot, and I realized I hadn't heard a shot fired the whole time. Even in the hazy visibility of the half-dark around me, the area felt deserted. I was now directly across from my car on the 2-lane road, keeping myself low to the ground. I popped my head up like a prairie dog.
Wendell? I called.
No answer. No shots fired. No movement in any direction, and no more sense of jeopardy. The night felt flat and totally benign at this point. I stood upright.
Wendell?
I did a 360 turn, sweeping my gaze across the immediate vicinity, and then sank down again. I looked both ways and crossed the street at a quick clip, keeping low. When I reached the car, I slid past the front bumper into home base.
Hey, it's me, I said.
There was only sea wind and empty beach.
Wendell Jaffe was gone again.
End of Disc 6. Disc 7.
Chapter 20. It was now 10 o'clock at night, and the roadway was deserted. I could see lights from the freeway tantalizingly close, but no one in their right mind was going to pick me up at that hour. I found my handbag by the car and hefted it over my shoulder. I went around to the driver's side and opened the car door.
I reached in, leaning forward to snag the keys from the ignition. I could have locked the car, but what would be the point? It wasn't running at the moment, and the rear window was shattered, open to the elements and any pint-sized little car thieves. I hiked to the nearest gas station, which was maybe a mile away. It was very dark, street lamps appearing at long intervals, and even then with only dim illumination. The storm had apparently stalled off the coast, where it lingered, brooding. Lightning winked through the inky clouds like a lamp with a loose connection. The wind whuffled across the sand, while dried fronds rattled in the palm trees. I did a quick self-assessment and decided I was in pretty good shape, given all the excitement. One of the virtues of physical fitness is that you can walk a mile in the dark and it's no big deal. I was wearing jeans, a short-sleeved sweatshirt, and my tennis bops. Not the best shoes for walking, but not agonizing either. The station itself was one of those places open 24 hours a day, but it was run largely by computer, with only one fellow in attendance. Naturally, he couldn't leave the premises. I got a handful of change and headed for the public phone booth in the corner of the parking lot. I called AAA first, giving them my number and told them where I was. The operator advised me to wait with the car, but I assured her I had no intention of hiking back in the dark. While I waited for the tow truck, I put a call through to Renata and told her what was happening. She didn't seem to bear me any grudges after our tussle on the boat deck for possession of the gun. She said Wendell wasn't home yet, but she'd hop in the car and cruise the route between the house and the frontage road where I'd last seen him. The tow truck finally appeared about 45 minutes later. I hopped in with the driver and directed him to my disabled car. He was a man in his 40s, apparently career tow truck, full of sniffs, tobacco chaws, and learned assessments. When we reached the vehicle, he stepped down from the truck and hiked his pants up, circling the VW with his hands on his hips. He paused and spat.
"What's the deal here?"
He might have been asking about the shattered rear window, but I ignored that for the moment. "I have no idea. I was tooling along about 40 miles an hour, and the car suddenly lost power." He reached toward the car roof, where a large caliber slug had punched a hole the size of a dime.
"Say, what is this?"
"Oh, you mean that?" I leaned forward, squinting in the half-light. The hole looked like a neat black polka dot against the pale blue paint. He stuck the tip of one finger into it.
"This here looks like a bullet hole."
"Gosh, it does, doesn't it?" We circled the car, and I echoed his consternation at all the hurt places we came across. He quizzed me at length, but I fended off his questions. The guy was a tow truck driver, not a cop, I thought. I was hardly under oath. Finally, head shaking, he slid onto the driver's seat and tried starting the car. I suspect he would have taken great satisfaction if the engine had fired right up. He struck me as the sort of fellow who didn't mind women looking foolish. No luck. He got out, went around, and peered in the back end. He grunted to himself, fiddled with some car parts, and tried the starter again without producing results. He towed the VW to the gas station, where he left it in a service bay, and then departed with sly glance backward and a shake of his head. No telling what he thought of little ladies these days. I had a chat with the attendant, who assured me the mechanic would be in by 7 the next morning. By now it was well after midnight, and I was not only exhausted, but I was stranded as well. I could have called Henry. I knew he'd have hopped in his car and driven down to fetch me at any hour without complaint. The problem was, I simply couldn't face the drive. Yet another lap in the track I was running between Santa Teresa and Perdido. Happily, the area wasn't short of motels. I spotted one on the far side of the freeway, within easy walking distance, and hoofed it across the overpass. In preparation for such emergencies, I always carry a toothbrush, toothpaste, and clean underpants shoved down in my handbag. The motel had one vacancy. I paid more than I wanted, but I was too tired to argue. For the extra $30, I was accorded one tiny bottle each of shampoo and conditioner. A matching container held just enough body lotion to moisturize one limb. The problem was you couldn't get the stuff out. I finally gave up the idea of being moist and went to bed stark naked and dry as a stick. I slept like a zombie without any medication and decided with regret that my cold was gone. I woke up at 6 o'clock, wondering briefly where I was. Once I remembered, I sank down under the covers and went back to sleep, not waking again until 8:25. I showered, donned my clean underwear, and then put on yesterday's clothes again. The room was paid for until noon, so I kept my key and grabbed a quick cup of coffee from the vending machine before I hiked back across 101 to my car. The mechanic was 18 years old, with frizzy red hair, brown eyes, a pug nose, a gap between his front teeth, and a thick Texas accent. The coverall he was wearing looked like a romper suit. When he saw me, he beckoned me over by doing curls with his index finger. He'd put the car up on the hydraulic lift, and we peered at the underside together. I could already picture dollars flying out the window. He wiped his hands on a rag and said, "Look it." I looked, not understanding at first what he was pointing to. He reached up and touched a vise clamp that had been affixed to a line.
"Somebody put this little dingus on your fuel line. I bet you only got about 3 blocks before the engine give out."
I laughed. "And that's all it was?" He unscrewed the clamp and dropped the little dingus in the palm of my hand.
"That's all. Car should run fine now."
"Thanks. This is great. How much do I owe you?"
"Thanks is good enough where I come from," he said.
I drove back to my motel room where I sat on the unmade bed and called Renata. Her machine picked up, and I left a message asking her to give me a call. I tried Michael's house next, surprised when he snatched up the phone after half a ring.
"Hi, Michael. This is Kinsey. I thought you'd be at work. Have you heard from your father?"
"Nuh-uh, and Brian hasn't either. He's called this morning to say Dad never showed. He really sounded worried. I called in sick so I could hang by the phone."
"Where is Brian?"
"He won't tell me. I think he's afraid I'll turn him into the cops before he and Dad connect up. You think Dad's okay?"
"That's hard to say."
I filled him in on events from the night before. "I left a message for Renata, and I hope to hear back. When I talked to her last night, she said she'd see if she could find him. She may have picked him up somewhere out on the road." There was a brief silence.
"Who's Renata?"
"Oops."
"She's a friend of your dad's. I think he's been staying at her place with her."
"She lives here in Perdido?"
"She has a house on the Keys." Another silence.
"Does my mom know?"
"I don't think so. Probably not."
"Man, oh man, what a jerk."
Silence again.
"Well, I guess I better let you go. I want to keep the line free in case he tries to get in touch."
I said, "You've got my number. Will you let me know if you should hear from him?"
"Sure," he said tersely.
I suspected any lingering sense of loyalty to his father had been erased with the news about Renata. I tried calling Dana. Her machine picked up. I listened to strains of the wedding march, drumming my fingers until I heard the beep. I left word for her to call me, keeping my message brief. I was still kicking myself for mentioning Renata in my conversation with Michael. Wendell had generated enough hostility in the kid without my adding the issue of his common-law wife. I tried reaching Lieutenant Reichman at the Perdido County Jail. He was out, but I had a quick chat with Senior Deputy Tiller, who told me there was a big department shake-up over Brian's unauthorized release. Internal Affairs was scrutinizing every employee who had access to the computer. Another call came through, and he had to ring off. I said I'd try Reichman again when I got back to Santa Teresa. I'd just about exhausted my list of local calls. I checked out of the motel and was on the road by 10 o'clock. I was hoping that by the time I reached the office in Santa Teresa, I'd have some return messages. But I unlocked my door to find the green light showing blankly on my answering machine. I spent the morning with my usual office routines, business calls and mail, a few bookkeeping entries, one or two bills to pay. I made a pot of coffee and then called my insurance adjuster to report last night's incident. She told me to go ahead and get the rear window replaced at the auto glass shop I'd used before. It was clear I couldn't ride around without protection because I'd be ticketed. In the meantime, I was half tempted to leave the bullet holes where they were. Make too many claims and you get your policy canceled, or your rates elevated to astronomical rates. What did I care about bullet holes? I was sporting a few of those myself. I called and made an appointment to have the window taken care of late afternoon. Shortly after lunch, Allison buzzed me to say Renata Huff was in the reception area. I went out to the front. She was sitting on the little sofa, head back, eyes closed. She was not looking good. She wore chinos bunched together and belted at the waist, and a black V-neck top with an orange anorak over it. Her dark curls were still damp from a recent shower, but her eyes were darkly circled and her cheeks seemed gaunt from stress. She pulled herself together with an apologetic smile at Allison, who seemed especially perky by comparison. I took Renata back to my office, sat her on my visitor's chair, and poured us both some coffee.
Thank you, she murmured, sipping gratefully.
She closed her eyes again, savoring the rich liquid on her tongue.
This is good. I need this.
You look tired.
I am.
It was really the first time I'd had a chance to study her closely. Her face in repose was not what I'd call pretty. Her complexion was lovely, clear olive tones without flaw or blemish. But her features seemed wrong, brows dark and untamed, dark eyes too small. Her mouth was large, and her short-cropped hair made her jaw look squared off. Her expression ordinarily had a petulant cast, but in the rare moments when she smiled, her whole face was transformed. Exotic, full of light. With her coloring, she could wear hues a lot of women couldn't get away with. Lime green, hot pink, royal blue, and fuchsia.
Wendell got home about midnight last night. This morning I went out to run errands. I couldn't have been gone for more than 40 minutes. When I came home, everything he owned was gone, and so was he. I waited for an hour or so and then got in my car and came up here. My real inclination was to call the police, but I thought I'd try you first and see what advice you might have to give.
About what?
He stole some money from me. $4,000 in cash.
What about the fugitive?
She shook her head wearily. He knows I'd kill him if he took that boat.
Don't you have a speedboat, too?
It's actually not a speedboat. It's an inflatable dinghy, but it's still at the dock. Anyway, Wendell doesn't have the keys to the fugitive.
Why not?
Her cheeks tinted slightly. I never trusted him.
You've been together 5 years and you didn't trust him with the keys to your boat?
He had no business on the boat without me, she said in an irritated tone.
I had to let that one pass.
So what's your suspicion? I think he went back for the Lord. God only knows where he means to go after that.
Why would he steal Eckert's boat?
He'd steal anything. Don't you get that? The Lord was his boat to begin with, and he wanted it back. Besides, the fugitive's a coastal cruiser. The Lord's a blue water boat better suited to his purpose.
Which is what?
Getting as far away from here as possible.
Why come to me?
I thought you'd know where the Lord was slipped. You said you talked to Carl Eckert on the boat. I didn't want to waste a lot of time at the harbor master's office trying to track him down.
Wendell told me Carl Eckert was out of town last night.
Of course he's gone. That's the point. He won't even miss the boat until he gets back.
She checked her watch. Wendell must have left Perdido about 10 this morning.
How'd he manage that? Did he get the car fixed?
He took the jeep I keep parked on the street. Even if it took him 40 minutes to get up here, the Coast Guard still has a chance to head him off.
Where would he go?
Back to Mexico, I'd guess. He knows the waters around the Baja, and he's got a counterfeit passport that identifies him as a Mexican citizen.
I'll get my car, I said.
We can take mine. We clattered down the steps together, me in front, Renata bringing up the rear.
You should notify the police about the jeep.
Good point. I'm hoping he left it somewhere in the marina parking lot.
Where'd he go last night, did he say? I lost track of him around 10. If he got home at midnight, what did he do for 2 hours? It doesn't take that long to walk a mile and a half.
I'm not sure. After you called, I got in my car and went looking for him. I scoured every street between my place and the beach, and there was no sign of him. From what he said later, I got the impression somebody came and got him, but he wouldn't say who. Maybe one of his boys.
I don't think so, I said. I talked to Michael a little while ago. He says Brian called this morning. Wendell was supposed to be there last night, but he never showed.
Wendell's never been good at promises.
Do you know where Brian is?
I have no idea. Wendell made sure I knew as little as possible. That way, if I was ever questioned by the police, I could claim ignorance.
This was apparently Wendell's standard operating procedure, but I wondered if this time keeping everybody ignorant was going to work against him.
We'd reached the street by then. Renata had defied all the parking gods and snagged a place right in front where the curb was painted red.
And did she have a ticket?
Of course not. She unlocked the Jag and I let myself into the passenger seat. Renata took off with a little chirp of her tires.
I found myself holding on to the chicken stick. Wendell might have gone to the cops, I said. From what he told Michael, he intended to turn himself in. With somebody shooting at him, he might have felt safer in the slammer. She made a little snort of contempt, flashing me a cynical look. He had no intention of turning himself in. That was bullshit. He mentioned he was going to see Dana, but that might have been bullshit, too.
He went to Dana's last night?
What was that about? I don't know that he went, but he said he wanted to talk to her before he left. He felt guilty about her. He hoped to get things squared away before he took off. He probably wanted to have his conscience clear.
You think he left without you?
I certainly think he has it in him, spineless bastard. He never faced the consequences of his own behavior, never. At this point, I don't care if he ends up in jail.
She seemed to be catching every traffic light. If there was no cross-traffic visible, she would sail through on red, skipping four-way stops altogether in her haste to reach the marina. Maybe she thought traffic laws were meant only as suggestions. Or maybe the traffic laws simply didn't apply to her that day.
I studied her profile, wondering how much information I could pump her for.
Do you mind if I ask about the logistics of Wendell's disappearance?
Like what? I shrugged, not quite sure where to start.
What arrangements did he make? I don't see how he could have managed it alone.
I could see her hesitate, so I tried a gentle coaxing, hoping she would open up.
I'm not just being nosy. I'm thinking whatever he did then, he might try again.
I didn't think she'd answer, but she finally slid a look in my direction. You're right. He couldn't pull it off without help, she said. I single-handed my catch down along the coast of Baja and picked him up in the dinghy after he abandoned the Lord.
That was risky, wasn't it? What if you'd missed him? The ocean's a big place.
I've sailed all my life, and I'm very good with boats. The whole plan was risky, but we pulled it off. That's the point, isn't it?
I guess so.
What about you? Do you sail yourself?
I shook my head.
Too expensive.
She smiled faintly.
Find a man with some money. That's what I've always done. I learned to ski and play golf. I learned to fly first class traveling around the world.
What happened to your first husband, Dean? I asked.
He died of a heart attack. He was actually number two.
How long has Wendell been traveling on his passport?
The whole 5 years, ever since we took off.
And the passport office never checked?
They slipped up on that, which is what gave us the idea in the first place. Dean died in Spain. Somehow the papers were never processed here. When his passport expired and the time came to renew, Wendell filled out the application and we substituted his picture. He and my husband were close enough in age to use Dean's birth certificate if the documentation was ever questioned. We reached Cabana Boulevard and turned right, the marina visible, with its forest of naked masts, to our left. The day was thickly overcast, a mist floating on the dark green waters of the harbor. I could smell brine shrimp and diesel fuel. A strong wind was blowing off the ocean, bringing with it the smell of a distant rain. Renata turned into the marina parking area and found a space in the tiny lot just outside the kiosk. She parked the Jag and the two of us got out. I led the way since I knew where the Captain Stanley Lord was slipped. We passed a funky little seafood restaurant with a few outside tables and the Naval Reserve building.
Then what?
She shrugged. After we got the passport, we took off. I would come back at intervals, usually by myself, but occasionally with Wendell. He stayed on the boat. I was free to come and go as I pleased, since no one knew of our connection. I kept an eye on the boys, though they didn't seem to be aware of it.
So when Brian first got in trouble with the law, Wendell knew all about it?
Oh, yes. At first he didn't worry. Brian's run-ins with the law seemed like childish pranks, truancy and vandalism.
Boys will be boys, I said.
She ignored that. We were off on a round-the-world cruise when things got out of hand. By the time we came home, Brian was in bigger trouble than we knew. That's when Wendell really went to work.
We passed a yacht brokerage and a fish market. The Navy pier extended to our left, a big marine travel rig in place. A boat had just been hoisted out of the water, and we had to wait impatiently while the long-legged mobile rig crept across the walkway and down the short avenue to our right.
Doing what? I still don't understand how he managed it. I'm not sure myself. It had something to do with the name of the boat.
The breakwater was nearly deserted, the threatening weather probably driving boats into port and people undercover.
Not directly, she went on.
From what he told me, Captain Stanley Lord was always blamed for something he didn't do.
He ignored the SOS from the Titanic, is what I heard, I said.
Or so people claimed. Wendell had done a lot of research on the incident, and he felt Lord was innocent.
I don't get the connection.
Wendell was in trouble with the law once himself.
Oh, that's right, I remember. Somebody mentioned that. He'd graduated from law school. He was convicted of manslaughter, wasn't he?
She nodded. I don't know the details.
He told you he wasn't guilty?
Oh, he wasn't, she said. He took the blame for somebody else. That's how he was able to get Brian out of jail, by calling in his marker.
I stared at her without slowing my pace. Did you ever hear of a guy named Harris Brown?
She shook her head in the negative.
Who's he?
An ex-cop. He was originally assigned to the fraud investigation after Wendell disappeared, but then he was pulled off. Turns out he'd invested a lot of money in Wendell's company, and the scam wiped him out. I was thinking he might have used some of his old connections to help Brian. I just can't figure out why he'd do it.
The ramp for Marina One was another 50 yards down on the left, the gate locked as usual. Seagulls were pecking intently at a fishing net. We stood there for a moment, hoping somebody with a key card would pass through so we could slipstream in behind them. Finally, I grabbed onto the fence post and held on while I climbed around on the outside of the barrier, working my way along the fencing until I reached the other side. I opened the gate for her and let her through, and we started off down the dock. Conversation between us dwindled. I turned into the sixth line of slips on the right, marked J, counting down visually to the slot where the Lord was tied up. Even from a distance, I could see the slip was empty and the boat was gone.
Chapter 21 Renata's mood darkened as we moved up the ramp toward the harbor master's office, which was located above a ship's chandler selling marine hardware and supplies. I half expected an outburst of some kind, but she was remarkably silent. She waited on a small wooden balcony outside while I went through the explanations with the clerk at the counter. Since we weren't the legal owners of the missing boat, and since there was no way we could prove Eckert hadn't taken the